From the studios of Books in Motion in Spokane, Washington, this is Cameron Byerly, reading Castle of Wizardry, Book 4 of the Belgariad by David Eddings. We begin with the prologue. Being an account of how Riva Irongrip became guardian of the Orb of Aldur and of the evil wrought by Nyssa, based upon the Book of Aelorn and later accounts. Now a time came when Kerak and his three sons went with Belgarath the Sorcerer into Meloria. Together they sought to reclaim the Orb of Aldur, which had been stolen by the maimed god Torak. And when they came to the place in the Iron Tower of Torak where the orb was hidden, only Riva Irongrip, youngest of the sons, dared seize the great jewel and bear it forth. For Riva alone was free of evil intent within his soul. And when they were come again to the west, Belgarath gave unto Riva and his descendants eternal guardianship of the orb, saying, "So long as the orb rests with you and your line, so long shall the west be safe." Then Riva took the orb and sailed with his people to the Isle of the Winds. There, upon the one place where ships might land, Riva caused to be built a citadel and a walled city around it, which men named thereafter Riva. It was a fortress city built for war. Within the citadel was built a great hall with a throne carved of black rock set against the wall, and men called this throne room the Hall of the Riven King. Then a deep sleep fell upon Riva, and Belar, bear god of the Aelorns, appeared to him in a dream, saying,
"Behold, guardian of the orb, I will cause two stars to fall from the sky, and thou shalt take up the two stars and place them in a fire and forge them. One shalt thou forge into a blade, the other into a hilt, and together they shall be a sword to guard the orb of my brother Aldur."
When Riva awoke, he saw two stars fall, and he sought and found them in the high mountains. And he did with them as Belar had instructed. But when it was done, the blade and the hilt could not be joined. Then Riva cried out, "Behold, I have marred the work, for the sword will not become one." A fox, which had sat nearby to watch him, said to Riva,
"The work is not marred, Riva. Take the hilt. Place the orb upon it as a pommel stone."
And when Riva did as the fox instructed, the orb became one with the hilt. But blade and hilt were still unjoined. Again the fox counseled him,
"Take the blade in your left hand, and the hilt in the right, and join them."
"They will not join. It is not possible," Riva said.
"Wise are you indeed," the fox said, "to know what is not possible before you have made the attempt."
Then Riva was ashamed. He set blade and hilt together, and the blade passed into the hilt as a stick slides into the water. The sword was joined forever. The fox laughed and said,
"Take this sword. Smite the rock which stands before you."
Riva feared for the blade, lest the blow shatter it, but he smote the rock. The rock broke in two, and water gushed forth in a river, and flowed down to the city below. Far to the east, in the darkness of Meloria, maimed Torak started up from his bed as a chill coursed through his heart. Again the fox laughed. Then it ran away, but stopped to look back. Riva saw that it was a fox no longer, but the great silver wolf form of Belgarath. Riva had the sword placed upon the face of the black rock wall that stood at the back of his throne, with its blade downward, so that the orb at its pommel stood at the highest point, and the sword cleaved itself to the rock. None but Riva could take it down. As the years passed, men saw that the orb burned with a cold fire when Riva sat upon the throne, and when he took down the sword and raised it, it became a great tongue of blue flame. In the early spring of the year after the sword was forged, a small boat came across the dark waters of the Sea of the Winds, moving without oars or sails. Alone within the boat was the fairest maid in all the world. Her name was Beldaran, beloved daughter of Belgarath, and she had come to be a wife to Riva. And Riva's heart melted with love for her, as had been ordained from the beginning of time. In the year that followed the wedding of Beldaran to Riva, a son was born to them upon Eristide. And upon the right hand of the son of Riva was the mark of the orb. Straightway Riva carried his infant man-child to the hall of the Riven King, and placed the tiny hand upon the orb. The orb knew the child, and glowed with love for him. Ever afterward, the hand of each descendant of Riva bore the mark of the orb that it might know him, and not destroy him when he touched it. For only one of Riva's line could touch the orb in safety. With each touch of infant hand upon the orb, the bond between Riva's line and the orb grew stronger, and with each joining the brilliance of the orb increased. Thus it was in the city of Riva for 1,000 years. Sometimes strangers sailed into the Sea of Winds, seeking trade. But the ships of Skerech, bound to defend the Isle of the Winds, fell upon the strangers and destroyed them. But in time, the Aelorn kings met and determined in council that these strangers were not the servants of Torak, but bowed instead to the god Nidra. Then they agreed to let the ships sail the Sea of Winds unmolested. For the Riven king told his fellow monarchs, "A time may come when the sons of Nidra will join with us in our struggle against Angarax of Torak One Eye. Let us not offend Nidra by sinking the ships of his children." The ruler of Riva spoke wisely, and the Aelorn kings agreed, knowing that the world was changing. Then treaties were signed with the sons of Nidra, who took a childish delight in signing scraps of parchment. But when they sailed into the harbor at Riva, with their ships bearing full loads of gaudy trinkets upon which they placed high value, the Raven King laughed at their folly, and closed the gates of the city to them. The sons of Nidra importuned the king, whom they called emperor, to force the city gates, so that they might hawk their wares in the streets, and the emperor sent his army to the isle. Now to permit these strangers from the kingdom they called Tolnidra passage upon the sea was one thing, but to let them land an army at the gates of Riva without challenge was quite another. The Raven King ordered that the strand before the city be cleared, and the harbor be swept clean of the ships of Tolnidra. And it was done. Great was the wrath of the Emperor of Tolnidra. He assembled his armies to cross the Sea of the Winds and do war. Then the peace-loving Aelorns held counsel to try reason upon this rash emperor. And they sent out a message to advise him that should he persist, they would rise up and destroy emperor and kingdom, and sweep the wreckage thereof into the sea. And the emperor gave heed to this quiet remonstrance, and abandoned his desperate adventure. As years passed, and the Riven King realized that these merchants from Tolnidra were harmless, he allowed them to build a village upon the strand before his city, and there to display their useless goods. Their desperation to sell or trade came to amuse him, and he asked his people to buy some few items from them, though no purpose could be found for the goods thus purchased. Then, 4,002 years from the day when accursed Torak raised the stolen orb and cracked open the world, other strange people came to the village, which the sons of Nidra had built outside the walls of Riva. And it was learned of these strangers that they were the sons of the god Issa. They called themselves Nai-Issans, and they claimed that their ruler was a woman, which seemed unnatural to all who heard. The name of this queen was Salmisra. They came in dissembling guise, saying that they brought rich gifts from their queen for the Riven King and his family. Hearing this, Gorek the Wise, aged king in the line of Riva, grew curious to know more of these children of Issa and their queen. With his wife, his two sons and their wives, and all his royal grandchildren, he went from out of the fortress and the city to visit the pavilion of the Nai-Issans, to greet them courteously, and to receive from them the valueless gifts sent by the harlot of Stithis Tor. With smiles of greeting, the Raven King and his family were welcomed into the pavilion of the strangers. Then the foul and accursed sons of Issa struck at all who were the fruit and seed of the line of Riva, and venom was anointed upon their weapons, so that the merest scratch was death. Mighty even in age, Garak struggled with the assassins, not to save himself, for he felt death in his veins from the first blow, but to save at least one of his grandsons, that his line might continue. Alas, all were doomed, save only one child, who fled and cast himself into the sea. When Garak saw this, he covered his head with his cloak, groaned, and fell dying beneath the knives of Nyssa. When word of this reached Brand, warder of the citadel, his wrath was dreadful. The traitorous assassins were overcome, and Brand questioned each in turn in ways that made brave men tremble, and the truth was wrung from them. Gorak and his family had been foully murdered at the instructions of Salmisra, Snake Queen of the Nyssans. Of the child who had cast himself into the sea, there was no trace. One assassin claimed that he had seen a snowy owl swoop down and bear the child away, but he was not believed, though even the severest urging would not make him change his story. Then, all Eloria made dreadful war upon the sons of Issa, and tore down their cities and put all they could find to the sword. And in her final hour, Salmisra confessed that the evil deed had been done at the urging of Torak One Eye and his servant Zedar. Thus there was no longer a Riven King and Guardian of the Orb, though Brand and those of the same name who followed reluctantly took up rule of Riva. Rumor, ever vagrant, persisted in the years that followed, saying that the seed of Riva still lay hidden in some remote land. But gray-cloaked Revan scoured the world in search of him, and never found him. The sword remained as Riva had placed it, and the orb was still affixed to its pommel, though now the jewel was ever dull and seeming without life. Men began to feel that so long as the orb was there, the West was safe, even though there was no Riven King. Nor did there seem aught of danger that the orb could ever be removed, since any man who touched it would be instantly and utterly consumed, were he not truly of the line of Riva. But now that his minions had removed the Riven King and Guardian of the Orb, Torak One-Eye again dared begin plans for the conquest of the West. And after many years, he led forth an enormous army of Angoraks to destroy all who opposed him. His hordes raved through all Algeria, and down through Arindia to the city of Volmimbre. Now Belgarath and his daughter Polgara, the sorceress, came to the one who was Brand and warder of Riva, to advise and counsel with him. With them, Brand led his army to Volmimbre, and in the bloody battle before that city, Brand drew upon the power of the orb to overcome Torak. Zedar spirited the body of his master away and hid it. But not all the disciples' skill could again awaken his god. And again men of the West felt safe, protected by the orb and Aldur. Now there came rumors of a prophecy that a Riven King, true seed of the line of Riva, should again appear and sit upon the throne in the hall of the Riven King. And in later years, some claimed that each daughter of an emperor of Tolnedra appeared on her 16th birthday to be the bride of the new king, should he appear. But few regarded such tales. Time passed into centuries, and still the West was safe. The orb remained quiet and dark upon the pommel of the sword. And somewhere, fearful Torak was said to sleep until the return of the Riven King, which came to mean never. And thus the account should be ended. But no true account can ever end, and nothing can ever be safe or sure so long as cunning men plot to steal or destroy. Again, long centuries passed, and then new rumors came, this time to disturb those in the highest places of power. And it was whispered that somehow the orb had been stolen. Then Belgarath and Polgara were seen to be moving through the lands of the West again, This time they took with them a young man named Garion, who named Belgarath his grandfather, and called Polgara his aunt. And as they moved through the kingdoms, they gathered upon them a strange company. To the Aelorn kings who gathered in council, Belgarath revealed that it was the apostate Zadar who had somehow contrived to steal the orb from the sword, and who was even then fleeing with it to the east, presumably to use it to awaken sleeping Torak. And it was there Belgarath must go with his company to rescue it. Then Belgarath discovered that Zadar had found a boy of total innocence who could safely touch the orb. But now the way led to the grim and dangerous headquarters of the Grolem priests of Torak, where the magician Tutchek had seized the orb and the boy from Zadar. In time, this quest of Belgarath and his company to regain the orb would come to be known as the Beleriand. But the end thereof lay entangled within prophecy, and even to the prophecy was the ultimate conclusion unknown. Part 1. Algeria. Chapter 1. Tuchik was dead, and more than dead, and the earth itself heaved and groaned in the aftershock of his destruction. Garion and the others fled down through the dim galleries that honeycombed the swaying basalt pinnacle, with the rocks grinding and cracking about them and fragments shattering away from the ceilings, raining down on them in the darkness. Even as he ran, Garion's mind jerked and veered, his thoughts tumbling over each other chaotically, stunned out of all coherence by the enormity of what had just happened. Flight was a desperate need, and he fled without thought or even awareness, his running steps as mechanical as his heartbeat. His ears seemed full of a swelling, exultant song that rang and soared in the vaults of his mind, erasing thought and filling him with stupefied wonder. Through all of his confusion, however, he was sharply conscious of the trusting touch of the small hand he held in his. The little boy they had found in Tulchuk's grim turret ran beside him with the orb of Aldur clasped tightly to his little chest. Garion knew that it was the orb that filled his mind with song. It had whispered to him as they had mounted the steps of the turret, and its song had soared as he had entered the room where it had lain. It was the song of the orb that obliterated all thought. More than shock or the thunderous detonation that had destroyed Tuchik and tumbled Belgarath across the floor like a rag doll or the deep sullen boom of the earthquake that had followed. Garion struggled with it as he ran, trying desperately to pull his wits into some kind of order. But the song intruded on his every effort, scattering his mind so that chance impression and random memory fluttered and scurried this way and that, and left him to flee without design or direction. The dank reek of the slave pens lying just beneath the disintegrating city of Rakhtol came sharply through the shadowy galleries. As if suddenly awakened by that single stimulus, a flood of memories of other smells crashed in on Garion's consciousness. The warm smell of fresh-baked bread in Aunt Paul's kitchen back at Faldor's farm, the salt smell of the sea when they had reached Darin on the north coast of Sindaria, and the first leg of their quest for the orb, the stink of the swamps and jungles of Nyssa, the stomach-turning smell of the burning bodies of the sacrificed slaves in the Temple of Torak, which even now shattered and fell in upon itself among the collapsing walls of Rakhtol. But, oddly, the smell that came sharpest to his confused memory was the sun-warmed scent of Princess Zenidra's hair. "Garion?" Aunt Paul's voice came sharply to him in the near dark through which they ran. "Watch where you are going." And he struggled to pull his mind back from its wandering, even as he stumbled over a pile of broken rock where a large stretch of ceiling had fallen to the floor. The terrified wails of the imprisoned slaves locked in clammy cells rose all around them now, joining in a weird counter-harmony with the rumble and boom of earthquake. Other sounds came from the darkness as well. Confused shouts in harshly accented Murgo voices, the lurching stagger of running feet, the clanging of an unlatched iron cell door swinging wildly as the huge rock pinnacle swayed and shuddered and heaved in the surging roll. Dust billowed through the dark caves, a thick, choking rock dust that stung their eyes and made them all cough almost continually as they clambered over the broken rubble. Geryon carefully lifting the trusting little boy over the pile of shattered rock, and the child looked into his face, calm and smiling, despite the chaos of noise and stink all around them in the oppressive dimness. He started to set the child down again, but changed his mind. It would be easier and safer to carry the boy. He turned to go on along the passageway, but he recoiled sharply as his foot came down on something soft. He peered at the floor, then felt his stomach suddenly heave with revulsion as he saw that he had stepped on a lifeless human hand protruding from the rockfall. They ran on through the heaving darkness with the black Murgle robes which had disguised them flapping around their legs and the dust still thick in the air about them.
"Stop!"
Relg, the Ulgo zealot, raised his hand and stood with his head cocked to one side, listening intently.
"Not here,"
Barak told him, still lumbering forward with the dazed Belgarath in his arms.
"Move, Relg! Be still,"
Relg ordered.
"I'm trying to listen."
And then he shook his head.
"Go back,"
he barked, turning quickly and pushing at them.
"Run! There are Murgos back there,"
Barak objected.
"Run,"
Relg repeated.
"The side of the mountain's breaking away."
Even as they turned, a new and dreadful creaking roar surrounded them. Screeching in protest, the rock ripped apart with a long, hideous tearing. A sudden flood of light filled the gallery along which they fled as a great crack opened in the side of the basalt peak, widening ponderously as a vast chunk of the mountainside toppled slowly outward to fall to the floor of the wasteland thousands of feet below. The red glow of the new-risen sun was blinding as the dark world of the caves was violently opened, and the great wound in the side of the peak revealed a dozen or more dark openings, both above and beneath, where caves suddenly ran out into nothingness.
"There!"
a shout came from overhead. Geryon jerked his head around. Perhaps 50 feet above and out along the sharp angle of the face, a half-dozen black-robed Murgos, swords drawn, stood in a cave mouth, with the dust billowing about them. One was pointing excitedly at the fleeing fugitives. And then the peak heaved again, and another great slab of rock sheared away, carrying the shrieking Murgos into the abyss beneath.
"Run!"
Relg shouted again. And they all pounded along at his heels, back into the darkness of the shuddering passageway.
"Stop for a minute,"
Barak gasped, plowing to a sudden halt after they had retreated several hundred yards.
"Let me get my breath."
He lowered Belgarath to the floor, his huge chest heaving.
"Can I help thee, my lord?"
Mandarallan offered quickly.
"No,"
Barak panted.
"I can manage it all right. I'm just a little winded."
The big man peered around.
"What happened back there? What set all of this off?"
"Belgarath and Tuchek had a bit of a disagreement,"
Silk told him, with a sardonic understatement.
"It got a little out of hand toward the end."
"What happened to Tuchek?"
Barak asked, still gasping for breath.
"I didn't see anybody else when Mandarallan and I broke into that room."
"He destroyed himself,"
Fulgara replied, kneeling to examine Belgarath's face.
"We saw no body, my lady,"
Mandarallan noted, peering into the darkness with his great broadsword in his hand.
"There wasn't that much of him left,"
Silk said.
"Are we safe here?"
Bulgara asked Relg. The Ulgo set the side of his head against the wall of the passageway, listening intently. Then he nodded.
"For the moment," he replied. "Let's stop here for a while, then. I want to have a look at my father. Make some light."
Relg fumbled in the pouches at his belt and mixed the two substances that gave off the faint Ulgo light. Silk looked curiously at Pulgara.
"What really happened?"
he asked her.
"Did Belgarath do that to Tuchek?"
She shook her head. her hands lightly touching her father's chest.
Tuchik tried to unmake the orb for some reason. Something happened to frighten him so much that he forgot the first rule.
A momentary flicker of memory came to Geryon as he set the little boy down on his feet, that brief glimpse of Tuchik's mind, just before the Grolem had spoken the fatal "be not" that had exploded him into nothingness. Once again, he caught that single image that had risen in the High Priest's mind, the image of himself holding the orb in his hand, and he felt the blind, unreasoning panic the image had caused Tuchik. Why? Why would that have frightened the Grolem into that deadly mistake?
"What happened to him, Aunt Paul?"
he asked. For some reason he had to know.
"He no longer exists,"
she replied.
"Even the substance that formed him is gone."
"That's not what I meant," Geryon started to object, but Marak was already speaking.
"Did he destroy the orb?"
the big man asked with a kind of weak sickness in his voice.
"Nothing can destroy the orb," she told him calmly.
"Where is it, then?"
The little boy pulled his hand free from Geryon's and went confidently to the big Kerach.
"Erend?"
he asked, holding out the round gray stone in his hand. Barak recoiled from the offered stone.
"Daylor,"
he swore, quickly putting his hands behind his back.
"Make him stop waving it around like that, Bolgra. Doesn't he know how dangerous it is?"
"No, I doubt it." "How's Belgarath?"
Silk asked.
"His heart is still strong," Bolgra replied. "He is exhausted, though. The fight nearly killed him."
With a long, echoing shudder, the quaking subsided, and the silence seemed very loud.
"Is it over?"
Gernik asked, looking around nervously.
"Probably not,"
Relg replied, his voice hushed in the sudden quiet.
"An earthquake usually goes on for quite some time."
Barak was peering curiously at the little boy.
"Where did he come from?"
he asked, his rumbling voice also subdued.
"He was in the turret with Tuchik,"
Polgara told him.
"He is the child Zadar used to steal the orb."
"He doesn't look like all that much of a thief."
"He isn't, precisely."
She looked gravely at the blonde-headed waif.
"Somebody's going to have to keep an eye on him," she observed. "There is something very peculiar about him. After we get down, I'll look into it, but I've got too much on my mind for that at the moment."
"Could it be the orb?" Silk asked curiously.
"I have heard that it has strange effects on people." Perhaps that's it."
But she didn't sound very convinced.
"Keep him with you, Geryon, and do not let him lose the orb."
"Why me?" He said it without thinking. She gave him a level gaze.
"All right, Aunt Paul."
He knew there was no point in arguing with her.
"What was that?"
Barak asked, holding up his hand for silence. Somewhere, off in the darkness, there was the murmur of voices, harsh, guttural voices.
"Nurgos,"
Silk whispered sharply, his hand going to his dagger.
"How many?"
Barak asked Aunt Paul.
5,
she replied.
"No, 6. One is lagging behind."
"Are any of them Grolems?"
She shook her head.
"Let's go, Mandaralan,"
the big Kerach muttered, grimly drawing his sword. The knight nodded, shifting his own broadsword in his hands.
"Wait here,"
Barak whispered to the rest of them.
"We shouldn't be long."
And then he and Mandaralan moved off into the darkness, their black Murgol robes blending into the shadows. The others waited, their ears straining to catch any sound. Once again that strange song began to intrude itself upon Geryon's awareness, and once again his thoughts scattered before its compulsion. Somewhere, a long, hissing slither of dislodged pebbles rattled down a slope, and that sound raised a confused welter of memory in him. He seemed to hear the ring of Durnik's hammer on the anvil at Faldor's farm, and then the plodding step of the horses and the creak of the wagons in which they had carried turnips to Darin back when this had all begun. As clearly as if he were there, He heard again the squealing rush of the boar he had killed in the snowy woods outside of Val Elorn, and then the aching song of the Arundish surf boy's flute that had soared to the sky from the stump-dotted field where Asharak the Murgo had watched with hate and fear on his scarred face. Geryon shook his head, trying to clear his thoughts, but the song drew him back into that bemused reverie. Sharply he heard the awful hissing crackle of Asharak burning beneath the vast, ancient trees in the wood of the Dryads, and heard the Grolem's desperate plea, "Master, have mercy." Then there were the screams in Salmisra's palace as Barak transformed into that dreadful bear shape, clawed and ripping his way toward the throne room, with Aunt Paul in her icy fury striding at his side. And then the voice that had always been in his mind was there again. "Stop fighting with it." "What is it?" Geryon demanded, trying to focus his thoughts.
"It's the orb." "What's it doing?"
"It wants to know you.
This is its way of finding things out." "Can't it wait? We don't really have time just now."
"You can try to explain that if you'd like." The voice sounded amused. "It might listen, but I doubt it."
"It's been waiting for you for a very long time." "Why me?"
"Don't you ever get tired of saying that?"
"Is it doing the same thing to the others?"
"To a lesser degree. You might as well relax. One way or another, it is going to get what it wants." There was a sudden ring of steel against steel somewhere off in the dark passageways and a startled cry. Then Geryon heard the crunch of blows and someone groaned. After that, there was silence. A few moments later, they heard the scuff of footsteps, and Barak and Mandorallan returned.
"We couldn't find that one who is coming along behind the rest of them," Barak reported. "Is Belgarath showing any signs of coming around yet?"
Polgara shook her head.
"He is still completely dazed."
"I'll carry him then. We had better go. It is a long way back down, and these caves are going to be full of Murgos before long."
"In a moment," she said. "Relg, do you know where we are?"
"Roughly."
"Take us back to the place where we left the slave woman," she instructed in a tone that tolerated no objection.
Relg's face went hard, but he said nothing. Barak bent and picked up the unconscious Belgarath. Geryon held out his arms, and the little boy obediently came to him, the orb still held protectively against his chest. The child seemed peculiarly light, and Geryon carried him with almost no effort. Relg lifted his faintly glowing wooden bowl to illuminate their path, and they started out again, twisting and turning, following a zigzag course that went deeper and deeper into the gloomy caves. The darkness of the peak above them seemed to bear down on Geryon's shoulders with a greater and greater weight the farther they went. The song in his mind swelled again, and the faint light Relg carried sent his thoughts roving once more. Now that he understood what was happening, it seemed to go more easily. The song opened his mind, and the orb leached out every thought and memory, passing through his life with a light, flickering touch. It had a peculiar kind of curiosity, lingering often on things Geryon did not think were all that important, and barely touching matters that had seemed so dreadfully urgent when they had occurred. It traced out in detail each step they had taken in their long journey to Rakhtal. It passed with them to the crystal chamber in the mountains above Meragor, where Geryon had touched the stillborn colt and given life in that oddly necessary act of atonement that had somehow made up for the burning of Ashrak. It went down with them into the vale where Geryon had turned over the large white rock in his first conscious attempt to use the will and the word objectively. It scarcely noticed the dreadful fight with Grol the Eldrak, nor the visit to the caves of Ulgo, but seemed to have a great curiosity about the shield of imagining which Geryon and Aunt Paul had erected to conceal their movements from the searching minds of the Grolems as they had approached Rakhtal. It ignored the death of Bryl and the sickening ceremonies in the Temple of Torak, but lingered instead on the conversation between Belgarath and Tuchuk in the Grolem High Priest's hanging turret. And then, most peculiarly, it went back to sift through every one of Geryon's memories of Princess Zenedra, of the way the sun caught her coppery hair, of the lithe grace of her movements, of her scent, of each unconscious gesture, of the flicker and play of emotion across her tiny, exquisite face. It lingered on her in a way that Geryon eventually found unsettling. At the same time, he found himself a bit surprised that so much of what the princess had said and done had stuck so firmly in his memory. "Geryon," Aunt Paul said, "what is the matter with you? I told you to hold on to the child. Now pay attention. This is not the time for daydreaming."
I was...
How could he explain it?
"You were what?"
"Nothing."
They moved on, and there were periodic tremors as the earth settled uneasily. The huge basalt pinnacle swayed and groaned each time the earth shuddered and convulsed under its base. And at each new quiver they stopped, almost fearing to breathe.
"How far down have we come?" Silk asked, looking around nervously.
1,000 feet, perhaps," Relg replied.
"That's all. We will be pinned up in here for a week at this rate."
Relg shrugged his heavy shoulders.
"It will take as long as it takes," he said in his harsh voice as they moved on.
There were Murgos in the next gallery, and another nasty little fight in the darkness. Mandaralan was limping when he came back.
"Why didn't you wait for me?"
Barak demanded crossly. Mandaralan shrugged.
"There were but 3, my lord."
"There is just no point in trying to talk to you. Do you know that?"
Barak sounded disgusted.
"Are you all right?"
Bolgara asked the knight.
"Oh, mere scratch, my lady," Mandaralan replied indifferently. "It is of no moment."
The rock floor of the gallery shuddered and heaved again, and the booming noise echoed up through the caves. They all stood frozen, but the uneasy movement of the earth subsided after a few moments. They moved steadily downward through the passageways and caves, the aftershocks of the earthquake that had shattered Rachthal and sent Tuchik's turret crashing to the floor of the wasteland of Murgos continued at intervals. At one point, hours later, it seemed, a party of Murgos, perhaps a dozen strong, passed through a gallery not far ahead, their torches casting flickering shadows on the walls and their harsh voices echoing. After a brief, whispered conference, Barak and Mandaralan let them go by unmolested and unaware of the terrible violence lurking in the shadows not 20 yards away. After they were out of earshot, Relg uncovered his light again and selected yet another passageway. They moved on, descending, twisting, zigzagging their way down through the caves toward the foot of the pinnacle and the dubious safety of the wasteland which lay outside. While the song of the orb did not diminish in any way, Geryon was at least able to think as he followed Silk along the twisting passageways with the little boy held in his arms. He thought that perhaps it was because he had grown at least partially accustomed to it, or maybe its attention was concentrated on one of the others. They had done it. That was the amazing thing. Despite all of the odds against them, they had retrieved the orb. The search that had so abruptly interrupted his quiet life at Faldor's farm was over. But it had changed him in so many ways that the boy who had crept out through the gate at Faldor's farm in the middle of a windswept autumn night no longer even existed. Geryon could feel the power he had discovered within himself even now, and he knew that power was there for a reason. There had been hints along the way. Vague, half-spoken, sometimes only implied, that the return of the orb to its proper place was only a beginning of something much larger and much more serious. Geryon was absolutely certain that this was not the end of it.
"It's about time," the dry voice in his mind said. "What's that supposed to mean? Why do I have to explain this every single time?"
"Explain what?"
"That I know what you're thinking. It's not as if we were completely separate, you know."
"All right, then. Where do we go from here?"
to Riva.
And after that?
We'll see.
You're not going to tell me?
No, not yet.
You haven't come nearly as far as you think you have. There's still a very long way to go.
If you aren't going to tell me anything, why don't you just leave me alone?
I just wanted to advise you not to make any long-term plans. The recovery of the orb was only a step, an important one, but only a beginning.
And then, as if mention of it somehow reminded the orb of Geryon's presence, its song returned in full force, and Geryon's concentration dissolved.
Not much later, Relg stopped, lifting the faint light aloft.
"What's the trouble?"
Barak demanded, lowering Belgarath to the floor again.
"The ceiling fell in,"
Relg replied, pointing at the rubble choking the passageway ahead.
"We can't get through."
He looked at Aunt Paul.
"I'm sorry,"
he said, and Geryon felt that he really meant it.
"That woman we left down here is on the other side of the cave-in."
"Find another way," she told him shortly.
"There isn't any. This was the only passageway leading to the pool where we found her."
"We will have to clear it, then."
Relg shook his head gravely.
"We'd just bring more of it down on top of us. It probably fell in on her as well. At least we can hope so."
"Isn't that just a bit contemptible, Relg?" Silk asked pointedly. The Ulgo turned to regard the little man.
"She has water there, and sufficient air to breathe. If the cave-in didn't kill her, she could live for weeks before she starves to death."
There was a peculiar quiet regret in Relg's voice. Silk stared at him for a moment.
"Sorry, Relg. I misunderstood."
"People who live in caves have no desire to see anyone trapped like that."
Olgara, however, was considering the rubble-blocked passageway.
"We have to get her out of there."
"Relg could be right, you know," Barak pointed out. "For all we know, she's buried under the half of the mountain."
Polgara shook her head.
"No,"
she disagreed.
"Taiba's still alive, and we cannot leave without her. She is as important to all of this as any one of us."
She turned back to Relg.
"You will have to go get her,"
she told him firmly. Relg's large dark eyes widened.
"You can't be asking that,"
he protested.
"There is no alternative."
"You can do it, Relg," Durnik encouraged the zealot. "You can go through the rock and bring her out the same way you carried Silk out of that pit where Tar Urgrus had him."
Relg had begun to tremble violently.
"I can't,"
his voice was choked.
"I'd have to touch her, put my hands on her. It's a sin." "Which is most uncharitable of thee, Relg,"
Mandarallan told him.
"There is no sin in giving aid to the weak and helpless. Consideration for the unfortunate is a paramount responsibility of all decent men. And no force in all of the world can curb the pure spirit. If compassion doth not move thee to fly to her aid, then mayest thou not, perhaps, regard her rescue a test of thy purity?" "You don't understand,"
Relg told him in an anguished voice. He turned back to Polgara.
"Don't make me do this. I beg of you."
"You must," she replied quietly. "I'm sorry, Relg, but there is no other way."
A dozen emotions played across the fanatic's face as he shrank under Aunt Paul's unrelenting gaze. Then, with a strangled cry, he turned and put his hand to the solid rock face at the side of the passageway. With a dreadful concentration, he pushed his fingers into the rock, demonstrating once more his uncanny ability to slip his very substance through seemingly unyielding stone. Silk quickly turned his back.
"I cannot stand to watch that,"
the little man choked. And then Relg was gone, submerged in the rock.
"Why does he make so much fuss about touching people?"
Barak demanded. But Geryon knew why.
His enforced companionship with the ranting the ride across Algeria had given him a sharp insight into the workings of Relg's mind. The harsh-voiced denunciations of the sins of others served primarily to conceal Relg's own weaknesses. Geryon had listened for hours at a time to hysterical and sometimes incoherent confessions about the lustful thoughts that raged through the fanatic's mind almost continually. Taiba, the lush-bodied Marag slave woman, would represent for Relg the ultimate temptation, and he would fear her more than death itself. In silence, they waited. Somewhere a slow drip of water measured the passing seconds. The earth shuddered from time to time as the last uneasy shocks of earthquake trembled beneath their feet. The minutes dragged on in the dim cavern. And then there was a flicker of movement, and Relg emerged from the rock wall carrying the half-naked Taiba. Her arms were desperately clasped about his neck, and her face was buried in his shoulder. She was whimpering in terror and trembling uncontrollably. Relg's face was twisted into an agony. Tears of anguish streamed openly from his eyes, and his teeth were clenched as if he were in the grip of intolerable pain. His arms, however, cradled the terrified slave woman protectively, almost gently. And even when they were free of the rock, he held her closely against him, as if he intended to hold her thus forever. Chapter 2 It was new reached the foot of the basalt tower and the large cave where they had left the horses. Silk went to the cave mouth to stand watch as Barak carefully lowered Belgarath to the floor.
"He's heavier than he looks," the big man grunted, wiping the sweat from his face. "Shouldn't he be starting to come around?"
"It may be days before he's fully conscious,"
Baldera replied.
"Just cover him and let him sleep."
"How is he going to ride?"
"I will take care of that."
"Nobody's going to be riding anywhere for a while," Silk announced from the narrow mouth of the cave. "The Murgos are swarming around out there like hornets."
"We'll wait until dark," Baldera decided. "We all need some rest anyway."
She pushed back the hood of her Murgo robe and went to one of the packs they had piled against the cave wall when they had entered the night before.
"I will see about something to eat, and then you had all better sleep."
Taiba, the slave woman, wrapped once again in Geryon's cloak, had been watching Relg almost continually. Her large violet eyes glowed with gratitude mingled with a faint puzzlement.
"You saved my life,"
she said to him in a rich, throaty voice. She leaned slightly toward him as she spoke. It was an unconscious gesture, Geryon was certain. But it was distinctly noticeable.
"Thank you,"
she added, her hand moving to rest lightly on the zealot's arm. Relg cringed back from her.
"Don't touch me," he gasped.
She stared at him in amazement, her hand still half extended.
"You must never put your hands on me," he told her. "Never."
Taiba's look was incredulous. Her life had been spent almost entirely in darkness, and she had never learned to keep her emotions from showing on her face. Amazement gave way to humiliation, and her expression settled then into a kind of stiff, sullen pout as she turned quickly away from the man who had just so harshly rejected her. The cloak slipped from her shoulders as she turned, and the few rags she had for clothing scarcely concealed her nakedness. Despite her tangled hair and the dirty smudges on her limbs, there was a lush, inviting ripeness about her. Relg stared at her and began to tremble. Then he quickly turned, moved as far away from her as possible, and dropped to his knees, praying desperately and pressing his face against the rocky floor of the cave.
"Is he all right?"
Taiba asked quickly.
"He's got some problems," Barak replied. "You'll get used to it."
"Taiba,"
Baldera said,
"come over here."
She looked critically at the woman's scanty clothing.
"We are going to have to get something together for you to wear. It is very cold outside. There are other reasons, too, it appears."
"I'll see what I can find in the packs," Dernick offered.
We'll need something for the boy, too, I think. That smock of his doesn't look any too warm.
He looked over at the child, who was curiously examining the horses.
You won't need to bother about me, Taiba told them. There's nothing out there for me. As soon as you leave, I'm going back to Rakhthol.
What are you talking about? Bogora asked her sharply.
I still have something to settle with Tuchik,
Taiba replied, fingering her rusty knife. Silk laughed from the cave mouth.
We took care of that for you. Rakhthol is falling to pieces up there, and there isn't enough left of Tuchik to make a smudge on the floor.
Dead?
She gasped.
How?
Oh, you wouldn't believe it, Silk told her.
Did he suffer?
She said it with a terrible eagerness.
More than you could ever imagine,
Bulgara replied. Taiba drew in a long, shuddering breath, and then she began to cry. Aunt Paul opened her arms and took the sobbing woman into them, comforting her even as she had comforted Geryon so often when he was small. Geryon sank wearily to the floor, resting his back against the rocky wall of the cave. Waves of exhaustion washed over him, and a great lassitude drained him of all consciously directed thought. Once again the orb sang to him, but lulling now. Its curiosity about him apparently was satisfied, and its song seemed to be there only to maintain the contact between them. Geryon was too tired even to be curious about why the stone took such pleasure in his company. The little boy turned from his curious examination of the horses and went to where Taiba sat with one of Aunt Paul's arms about her shoulders. He looked puzzled and reached out with one hand to touch his fingers to her tear-streaked face.
"What does he want?"
Taiba asked.
"He has probably never seen tears before,"
Aunt Paul replied. Taiba stared at the child's serious little face, and then suddenly laughed through her tears and gave him a quick embrace. The little boy smiled then.
"Erand?"
he asked, offering her the orb.
"Do not take it, Taiba," Polgara told her very quietly. "Don't even touch it."
Taiba looked at the smiling child and shook her head. The little boy sighed, then came across the cave, sat down beside Geryon, and nestled against him. Barak had gone a short distance back up the passageway they had followed. Now he returned, his face grim.
"I can hear Murgos moving around up there," the big man reported. "You cannot tell how far away they are, with all of the echoes in these caves, but it sounds as if they were exploring every cave and passageway." "Let us find some defensible spot, then, my lord, and give them reason to look for us elsewhere," Mandaraman suggested gaily.
Interesting notion," Barak replied. "But I'm afraid it wouldn't work. Sooner or later they're going to find us."
"I'll take care of it,"
Relg said quietly, breaking off his praying and getting to his feet. The ritual formulas had not helped him, and his eyes were haunted.
"I'll go with you," Barak offered.
Relg shook his head.
"You'd just be in my way," he said shortly,
already moving toward the passage leading back into the mountain.
"What's come over him?" Barak asked, puzzled.
"I think our friend's having a religious crisis," Silk observed from the mouth of the cave where he kept watch.
"Another one?"
"Oh, it gives him something to occupy his spare moments," Silk replied lightly. "Come and eat," Aunt Paul told them, laying slices of bread and cheese on top of one of the packs. "Then I want to have a look at that cut on your leg, Mandaraman." After they had eaten, and Polgara had bandaged Mandaralan's knee, she dressed Taiba in a peculiar assortment of clothes Durnik had taken from the packs. Then she turned her attention to the little boy. He returned her grave look with one just as serious, then reached out and touched the white lock at her brow with a curious finger. With a start of remembrance, Geryon recalled how many times he had touched that lock with the self-same gesture, and the memory of it raised a momentary irrational surge of jealousy, which he quickly suppressed. The little boy smiled with a sudden delight.
Arand,
he said firmly, offering the orb to Aunt Paul. She shook her head.
No, child,
she told him.
I am afraid I am not the one.
She dressed him in clothing that had to be rolled up and taken in with bits of twine in various places, then sat down with her back against the wall of the cave and held out her arms to him. Obediently, he climbed into her lap, put one arm about her neck, and kissed her. Then he nestled his face down against her, sighed, and immediately fell asleep. She looked down at him with a strange expression on her face, a peculiar mixture of wonder and tenderness. And Geryon fought down another wave of jealousy. There was a grinding rumble in the caves above them.
What's that?
Durnik asked, looking around with apprehension.
Relg, I'd imagine,
Silk told him.
He seems to be taking steps to head off the Murgos.
I hope he doesn't get carried away,
Durnik said nervously, glancing at the rock ceiling.
How long's it going to take to get to the Vale?
Barak asked.
A couple of weeks, probably, Silk replied. A lot's going to depend on the terrain and how quickly the Grolems can organize a search for us. If we can get enough of a head start to put down a good false trail, we can send them all running off to the west toward the Thalnedrin border, and we can move toward the Vale without needing to waste all that time dodging and hiding.
The little man grinned.
The notion of deceiving the whole Murgon nation appeals to me, he added.
You don't have to get too creative, Barak told him. Hetar's going to be waiting for us in the Vale, along with King Chohag and half the clans of Algeria. They will be awfully disappointed if we don't bring them at least a few Murgos.
Oh, life is full of little disappointments, Silk told him sardonically. As I remember it, the eastern edge of the Vale is very steep and rough. It will take a couple of days at least to make it down. And I do not think we'll want to try it, with all of Murgodom snapping at our heels.
It was mid-afternoon when Relg returned. His exertions seemed to have quieted some of the turmoil in his mind, but there was still a haunted look in his eyes, and he deliberately avoided Tyba's violet-eyed gaze.
"I pulled down the ceilings of all the galleries leading into this cave," he reported shortly. "We are safe now."
Polgara, who had seemed asleep, opened her eyes. "Get some rest," she told him. He nodded and went immediately to his blankets. They rested in the cave through the remainder of the day, taking turns on watch at the narrow opening. The wasteland of black sand and wind-scoured rock lying out beyond the tumbled scree at the base of the pinnacle was alive with Murgle horsemen, scurrying this way and that in a frenzied, disorganized search.
"They don't seem to know what they're doing,"
Geryon observed quietly to Silk, as the two of them watched. The sun was just sinking into a bank of cloud on the western horizon, staining the sky a fiery red, and the stiff wind brought a dusty chill with it as it seeped into the cave opening.
"I imagine that things are a bit scrambled up in Rakhtal," Silk replied. "No one is in charge anymore, and that confuses the Murgos. They tend to go all to pieces when there's nobody around to give them orders." "Isn't that going to make it hard for us to get out of here?" "What I mean is that they are not going any place. They're just milling around. How are we going to get through them?"
Silk shrugged.
"We will just pull up our hoods and mill around with the rest of them."
He pulled the coarse cloth of the Murgo robe he wore closer about him to ward off the chill and turned to look back into the cave. "The sun is going down," he reported.
"Let's wait until it is completely dark,"
Polgara replied. She was carefully bundling the little boy up in one of Geryon's old tunics.
"Once we get out a ways, I will drop a few odds and ends," Silk said. "Murgos can be a little dense sometimes, and we would not want them to miss our trail."
He turned to look back out at the sunset.
"It is going to be a cold night,"
he remarked, to no one in particular.
"Geryon,"
Aunt Paul said, rising to her feet,
"you and Durnik stay close to Tyba. She has never ridden before, and she might need some help at first."
"What about the little boy?" Durnik asked.
"He will ride with me."
"And Belgarath?"
Mandarallan inquired, glancing over at the still-sleeping old sorcerer.
"When the time comes, we will just put him on his horse,"
Bulgarer replied.
"I can keep him in his saddle as long as we do not make any sudden changes in direction. Is it getting any darker?"
"We had better wait for a little longer," Silk answered. "There is still quite a bit of light out here." They waited. The evening sky began to turn purple, and the first stars came out, glittering cold and very far away. Torches began to appear among the searching Murgos.
"Shall we go?"
Silk suggested, rising to his feet. They led their horses quietly out of the cave and down across the scree to the sand. There they stopped for several moments while a group of Murgos carrying torches galloped by several hundred yards out.
"Don't get separated,"
Silk told them as they mounted.
"How far is it to the edge of the wasteland?"
Berek asked the little man, grunting as he climbed up onto his horse.
2 days hard riding," Silk replied. "Or nights, in this case. We'll probably want to take cover when the sun is out. We don't look all that much like Murgos."
"Let's get started,"
Bulgarer told him. They moved out at a walk, going slowly until Taiba became more sure of herself and Belgarath showed that he could stay in his saddle, even though he could not yet communicate with anyone. Then they nudged their horses into a canter that covered a great deal of ground without exhausting the horses. As they crossed the first ridge, they rode directly into a large group of Murgos carrying torches.
"Who's there?"
Silk demanded sharply, his voice harsh with the characteristic accent of Murgos' speech.
"Identify yourselves."
"We are from Raxal,"
one of the Murgos answered respectfully.
"I know that, blockhead,"
Silk barked.
"I asked your identity."
"Third phalanx,"
the Murgo said stiffly.
"That's better. Put out those torches. How do you expect to see anything beyond 10 feet with them flaring in your eyes?"
The torches were immediately extinguished.
"Move your search to the north,"
Silk commanded.
"The 9th phalanx is covering this sector."
"But..."
"Are you going to argue with me?"
"No, but move now."
The Murgos wheeled their horses about and galloped off into the darkness.
"Clever,"
Berek said admiringly. Silk shrugged.
"Pretty elementary," he replied. "People are grateful for a bit of direction when they're confused. Let's move along, shall we?"
There were other encounters during the long, cold, moonless night as they rode west. They were inescapable, in view of the hordes of Murgos scouring the wasteland in search of them. But Silk handled each such meeting smoothly, and the night passed without significant incident. Toward morning, the little man began artfully dropping various articles to mark their trail.
"A bit overdone, perhaps,"
he said critically, looking at an old shoe he had just tossed into the hoof-churned sand behind them.
"What are you talking about?"
Berek asked him.
"Our trail," Silk replied. "We want them to follow us, remember? They are supposed to think that we are headed toward Tonedra."
"So?"
"I was just suggesting that this is a bit crude."
"You worry too much about things like that."
"It is a question of style, my dear Berek,"
Silk replied loftily.
"Sloppy work tends to be habit-forming."
As the first steel-gray light of dawn began to creep across the wintry sky, they took shelter among the boulders of one of the ridges that laced the floor of the wasteland. Dernek, Berek, and Mandoralan stretched the canvas of their tents tautly over a narrow ravine on the west side of the ridge and sprinkled sand on top of it to disguise their makeshift shelter.
"It's probably best not to build a fire,"
Dernek said to Polgara, as they led their horses in under the canvas.
"What with the smoke and all?"
She nodded her agreement.
"We could all use a hot meal," she said. "But I suppose it will have to wait."
They ate a cold breakfast of bread and cheese and began to settle in, hoping to sleep out the day so that they could ride on the next night.
"I could definitely use a bath,"
Silk said, brushing sand out of his hair. The little boy looked at him, frowning slightly. Then he walked over and offered him the orb.
"Elrond?"
he asked. Selk carefully put his hands behind his back and shook his head.
"Is that the only word he knows?"
he asked Polgara.
"It seems to be," she replied.
"I don't quite get the connection," Silk said. "What does he mean by it?"
"He has probably been told that he has an errand to run," she explained, "to steal the orb. I imagine that Zadar's been telling him that over and over since he was a baby, and the words stuck in his mind."
"It's a bit disconcerting." Silk was still holding his hands behind his back.
"It seems oddly appropriate sometimes." "He doesn't appear to think the way we do," she told him. "The only purpose he has in life is to give the orb to someone, anyone, it would seem."
She frowned thoughtfully.
"Durnick, why don't you see if you can make him some kind of pouch to carry it in, and we will fasten it to his waist? Maybe if he doesn't have it right there in his hand all of the time, he won't think about it so much."
"Of course, Mr. Spall," Durnick agreed. "Should have thought of that myself."
He went to one of the packs and took out an old, burn-scarred leather apron and fashioned a pouch out of a wide piece of leather he cut from it.
"Boy," he said when he had finished, "come here."
The little boy was curiously examining a small, very dry bush at the upper end of the ravine, and gave no indication that he knew the smith was calling him.
"You! Errand!" Durnick said.
The little boy looked around quickly and smiled as he went to Durnick.
"Why did you call him that?"
Silk asked curiously.
Durnick shrugged. "He seems to be fond of the word. Answers to it. It'll do for a name until we can find something more suitable, I suppose."
"Errand?"
the child asked, offering the orb to Durnick. Durnick smiled at him, bent over and held the mouth of the pouch open.
"Put it near, Errand," he instructed, "and we'll tie it up all nice and safe so you won't lose it."
The little boy delightedly deposited the orb in the leather pouch.
"Errand,"
he declared firmly.
"I suppose so," Durnick agreed.
He pulled the drawstring tight and then tied the pouch to the bit of rope the boy wore as a belt.
"There we are, Errand. All safe and secure now."
Errand examined the pouch carefully, tugging at it a few times as if to be sure it was tightly tied. Then he gave a happy little laugh, put his arms about Durnick's neck, and kissed his cheek.
"Ah, he's a good lad," Durnick said, looking a trifle embarrassed.
"He is totally innocent,"
Aunt Paul told him, from where she was examining the sleeping Belgarath.
"He has no idea of the difference between good and evil, so everything in the world seems good to him." "I wonder what it is like to see the world that way,"
Tyba mused, gently touching the child's smiling face.
"No sorrows, no fear, no pain. Just to love everything you see because you believe that everything is good."
Relg, however, had looked up sharply. The troubled expression that had hovered on his face since he had rescued the trapped slave woman fell away to be replaced by that look of fanatic zeal that it had always worn before.
"Monstrous," he gasped.
Tyba turned on him, her eyes hardening.
"What is so monstrous about happiness?"
she demanded, putting her arm about the boy.
"We aren't here to be happy," he replied, carefully avoiding her eyes.
"Why are we here, then?"
she challenged.
"To serve our God and to avoid sin."
He still refused to look at her, and his tone seemed a trifle less certain.
"Well, I do not have a God," she retorted. "And the child probably doesn't either. So if it is all the same to you, he and I will just concentrate on trying to be happy. And if a bit of sin gets involved in it, so what?"
"Have you no shame?"
His voice was choked.
"I am what I am," she replied. "And I won't apologize, since I didn't have very much to say about it."
"Boy," Rog snapped at the child, "come away from her at once."
Tyba straightened, her face hardening even more, and she faced him defiantly.
"What do you think you're doing?" she demanded.
"I will fight sin wherever I find it," he declared.
Sin, 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 she flared. Is that all you ever think about?
It's my constant care. I guard against it every moment, she laughed.
How tedious. Can't you think of anything better to do? Oh, I forgot, she added mockingly. There is all that praying, too, isn't there? All that bawling at your God about how vile you are. I think you must bore this ull of yours tremendously sometimes. Do you know that?
Enraged, Relg raised his fist. Don't ever speak Ull's name again.
Will you hit me if I do? It doesn't matter that much. People have been hitting me all of my life. Go ahead, Relg. Why don't you hit me?
She lifted her smudged face toward him. Relg's hand fell. Sensing her advantage, Tyba put her hands to the throat of the rough gray dress Poldera had given to her.
I can't stop you, Relg, she told him.
She began unfastening the dress.
Watch me. You look at me all the time anyway. I have seen you with your hot eyes on me. You call me names and say that I am wicked, but still you watch. Look, then. Don't try to hide it.
She continued to unfasten the front of the dress.
If you are so free of sin, my body should not bother you at all.
Relg's eyes were bulging now.
My body does not bother me, but it bothers you very much, doesn't it? But is the wickedness in my mind or in yours? I can sink you in sin any time I want to. All I have to do is this.
And she pulled open the front of her dress. Relg spun about, making strangled noises.
Don't you want to look, Relg?
She mocked him as he fled.
You have a formidable weapon there, Tyba, Silk congratulated her.
It was the only weapon I had in the slave pens, she told him. I learned to use it when I had to.
She carefully rebuttoned her dress and turned back to Arend, as if nothing at all had happened.
What is all of the shouting?
Belgarath mumbled, rousing slightly, and they all turned quickly toward him.
Relg and Tyba were having a little theological discussion, Silk replied lightly. The finer points were very interesting. How are you?
But the old man had already drifted back into sleep.
At least he's starting to come around, Durnick noted.
It will be several days before he has fully recovered,
Polgara told him, putting her hand to Belgarath's forehead.
He is still terribly weak.
Geryon slept for most of the day, wrapped in his blankets and lying on the stony ground. When the chill and a particularly uncomfortable rock under his hip finally woke him, it was late afternoon. Silk sat guard near the mouth of the ravine, staring out at the black sand and the grayish salt flats, but the rest were all asleep. As he walked quietly down to where the little man sat, Geryon noticed that Aunt Paul slept with Arend in her arms, and he pushed away a momentary surge of jealousy. Tyba murmured something as he passed, but a quick glance told him that she was not awake. She was lying not far from Relg. In her sleep, her hand seemed to be reaching out toward the slumbering Ulgo. Silk's sharp little face was alert, and he showed no signs of weariness.
Good morning, he murmured. Or whatever. Don't you ever get tired?
Geryon asked him, speaking quietly so that his voice would not disturb the others.
I slept a bit, Silk told him.
Durnick came out from under the canvas roof to join them, yawning and rubbing at his eyes.
Oh, I'll leave you now, he said to Silk. Did you see anything?
He squinted out toward the lowering sun. Silk shrugged.
Some Margos. They were a couple of miles off to the south. I don't think anyone's found our trail yet. We might have to make it a little more obvious for them.
Geryon felt a peculiar, oppressive sort of weight on the back of his neck. He glanced around uncomfortably. Then, with no warning, there was a sudden sharp stab that seemed to go straight into his mind. He gasped and tensed his will, pushing the attack away.
What is wrong? Silk asked sharply. A Grolem,
Geryon snarled, clenching his will as he prepared to fight.
Geryon!
It was Aunt Paul, and her voice sounded urgent. He turned and darted back in under the canvas with Silk and Durnick on his heels. She had risen to her feet and was standing with her arms protectively about Erand.
"That was a Krolem, wasn't it?"
Geryon demanded, his voice sounding a bit shrill.